Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network, our 50th edition, with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, which country is the second easiest in the world to set up anonymous shell companies after Kenya? We take a look at an expose of lawyers recorded undercover, saying things they really must wish they hadn't. But first, here's a quick roundup of this month's Tax Justice news. Will they or won't they? The UK-based bank HSBC has been spinning the line it might relocate to Hong Kong if the British government doesn't fulfil a list of requests which included a reduction in the banking levy and an even more see no evil, report no evil environment to operate in. This month, they've announced they've decided to stay, although nobody in the tax justice movement ever believed they had any intention of leaving regulation light London. The European Central Bank finally wants to abolish 500 euro bills after decades of research showing their role in global money laundering, corruption, tax dodging and organised crime. Better late than never. Mega furniture company IKEA faces accusations it underpaid its taxes by 1 billion euros by using European tax havens. The European Commission's set to take a look, and it may be about to investigate the tax deal Google struck with the UK, paying an effective tax rate of below 3%. We'll have more on that later. And the US Treasury Secretary is not too happy about all these European investigations into anti-competitive behaviour, and he's written to the European Commission to ask them to stop picking on poor little tax-dodging multinational corporations. He thinks the Commission's unfairly singling out US firms. No, it's more like they're singling out the ones that excel at profit-shifting. And there's strong support coming now from European Union officials for public country-by-country reporting for multinational companies, so we'll know the real substance of their business activities in each location they operate. Last month, we reported on the member of the European Parliament, Fabio De Masi, who took the European Commission to court over its refusal to release documents on high-level meetings about tax policy. Well, in the face of legal action, they've backed down and now say they will give members of the European Parliament access after all. Last month in the TaxCast, John Christensen said he'd eat his hat if these documents didn't show systematic political backup for a tax avoidance cartel. We may now get to find out, although it's not clear yet to what extent the Commission will in fact cooperate. So that's one to watch. And finally, the Netherlands is to join a growing list of countries that have decided to grant public access to their beneficial ownership register, their record of the real owners of companies which European Union member states are supposed to be committed to implementing. It seems the Dutch government has decided that restricting public access with a so-called legitimate interest test would be too expensive and too complicated. Those are the Tax Justice News headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, we've got to start this month talking about the Google story. Lots of things have happened as a consequence now of the British Chancellor very unwisely announcing at Davos in Switzerland, I think, that the British government has got Google to pay tax after many years, and what a great step forward it is. And he ended up looking pretty silly because it turned out they were paying a pittance, and even Rupert Murdoch was criticising it. And it turns out they were paying something like an effective UK tax rate of 2.77%, according to our friend, the Professor of Accounting, Prem Sika. That's his estimate. They actually paid £130 million in back taxes for the years 2005 to 2011. And, the UK's Google's second largest market after the US, so it's not very much money. And to put that into a bit of perspective as well and add a bit of insult to injury, they're going to be paying Italy about £172 million in back taxes from 2009 to 2013, even though that's a fraction of the size, obviously, of its UK sales. So what's going on?
Well, it does seem extraordinary that the UK government, and particularly the UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, who's widely regarded as very careful and very effective at his public relations, messaging, "Get it so terribly wrong on Google." The settlement was a terrible settlement, well below 3%. Prem Sekar is almost certainly correct in his analysis. £13 million a year for the second biggest market for Google in the world tells us several things. First of all, that HM Revenue and Customs in the UK has done a very bad deal, and very probably, judging from the number of political meetings between Google and ministers, this deal has been shaped by political pressure. Tax departments normally should be completely separate from political pressure. But it also tells us that the OECD BEPS, the Base Erosion Profit Shifting Programme, really hasn't tackled the issue of how to tax modern multinational companies in the current economy. Google uses Ireland and Bermuda to shift its profits out of the UK. Google's own figures say they have something in the region of 4,000 employees in the United Kingdom, 5,000 in Ireland, and none in Bermuda at all. And yet Bermuda, they say, is where the value is located. We need to challenge that, because it isn't just a matter of some very careful and well-crafted algorithms belonging to a Bermudan company that matters here. What Google is really doing is harvesting a lot of data, which we provide them through our smartphones and through our laptops and our PCs, which they then use to run through a number of algorithms and return to us with some very finely targeted marketing and advertising material, which ends up on our screen. That's how they make their money. The value is being created by us. And we, of course, are sitting here in the UK or wherever, whichever country, and that the taxing rights should belong there. What this signals to me more than anything else is that the OECD now needs to abandon entirely its futile attempt to make the old system of taxing multinational companies based on this idea of a separate entity in Bermuda, which is where they park their profits. That's where the taxing rights should arise. What we need to move towards is taxing Google on the basis of them being a single global company, and let's look at where their sales actually occur. And that would almost certainly give the United Kingdom a much higher level of profit to tax. So the time is right to move towards what's known as unitary taxation. And the Google story, I think, illustrates this to a very, very large extent.
And they're always able to say, Google complies with the tax laws in every country where we operate. But we're not able to test that really, are we? Because we don't really have the full breakdown of what is going on in each country in reality. What about if we do end up with public country by country reporting? How would that help with something like Google?
Well, I think that country-by-country reporting, which of course TJN has pushed for since 2003, we've been at the forefront of campaigning for country-by-country reporting, precisely because what that would do is to reveal what their sales are in the United Kingdom, how many people they employ here, what profits they're actually generating in this country, and therefore we'd start to get a feel for what their tax liability should be, rather than the big pretenses that they put up. Because at the moment, all we get is, in terms of information, is the global consolidated accounts, and we know what profits they're making globally. We have no real way of knowing how those profits are allocated between the different subsidiaries they have in different countries. What we do know, of course, is that the Bermudan company, where they say all the profits are due and taxable, employs no one, has very little part to play in the value chain, and therefore that's not where the taxable rights should be lying. Country-by-country reporting, I think, is a key step in the direction of making unitary taxation a viable proposition.
Right, and public country-by-country reporting has received quite a lot of support from some quite important figures in the European Union the last couple of weeks, which is good news. But this, obviously, Google's just one of a long line of multinational companies paying tiny levels of tax, and pressure is mounting on the European Commission to launch a full state aid investigation into the UK's tax settlement with Google. And in fact, the Tax Justice Network has also asked the Commission to investigate all UK corporate tax deals. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, you're right. I mean, first of all, it's so important what you said just now about making this information, country by country reporting information, available to the public is absolutely crucial, because, and I regret to say it, I really do, we cannot trust the tax authorities any longer to act in the public interest. It is quite clear that as a result of political lobbying and state capture, that the politicians in many countries, and I think the same applies to the United Kingdom, can no longer be trusted to not interfere constantly with the supposedly independent tax authorities. And for that reason, we, the public, need to have access to this information so we can judge for ourselves whether the settlements, the deals that are being done in our name and on our behalf, are actually reasonable deals. The evidence so far suggests that we cannot trust the revenue authorities to arrive at reasonable deals because of the level of political interference. And, of course, we welcome the European Commission's suggestion that they will investigate the Google deal. But in the letter I sent to the Commission this month, I've said, don't stop with Google. Look at all of the deals that have been done in the last year between the UK government and other multinational enterprises, because I'd be very surprised if we haven't had similar, very poor deals struck with those companies. And that's not only bad news for the British citizens, who, of course, are not getting the revenues they need at a time of austerity. It's also bad news for the rest of Europe, because these deals undermine the proper functionings of a market. They are anti-market. They distort the market economy. If one company is being given special treatment not available to others, then that's putting them at a disadvantage and distorting market competition. So it's very, very important that these deals are investigated right across the board to make sure that governments stop doing these special deals.
Okay, let's go right to the other side of the world now and talk about Taiwan, because it's come to the Tax Justice Network's attention this month. It's really, until now, has been a rather unnoticed tax haven.
Yeah, and Taiwan is one of those places that's been not off our radar. It's been on our radar, but it's been right at the edge of the screen because we just don't have enough information available to us about Taiwan. And there's a number of reasons for that. First of all, there's very little good information about how much money is flowing into and out of Taiwan. Secondly, international organisations, and this might well also apply to the OECD as well as the IMF, really haven't collected that much information about Taiwan, because Taiwan and China have been in dispute for decades, and China makes it clear that they want Taiwan to be kept completely out of the picture. No one can effectively engage with Taiwan. And that means that Taiwan appears to have been slipping below the horizon. What's clear is that Taiwan is emerging as a very major offshore financial center. The last few years, a huge amount of money has been flowing into Taiwan through things called OBUs. Now, what is an OBU? This is a facility rather similar to the euro dollar market in the UK and the international banking facilities in the US. The OBU is an overseas banking unit business. Businesses that can take deposits not in Taiwanese currency but in any currency from anywhere in the world and transact them, manage them in Taiwan, pretty much free from all taxes. OBUs are exempt from reserve requirements, they're exempt from corporate tax, they're exempt from withholding tax, exempt from stamp duties. In other words, what we have is a classic tax haven facility here. And the numbers are quite impressive, because we've seen a steady build-up in the volume of funds held in these offshore OBUs. To give some idea of the scale of growth of the funds being transacted through OBUs and through the offshore financial centre in Taiwan, it's grown from about 160 billion in 2013 to 187 billion US dollars. And that's a significant increase over the last few years, and it's rising very fast. But perhaps more importantly, we should be looking at the types of banks that are operating there. Bearing in mind, small island and so on, we're seeing all of the biggest players. You've got Deutsche Bank and Citibank, Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, Bank Bilbao Vizcaya, JP Morgan, United China Bank, Wells Fargo, Wachovia Bank, Standard Chartered Bank, Scotia Bank from Canada. All the big players are there. A sure sign that Taiwan is emerging very, very fast as a major offshore financial centre.
And they're signed up to precisely no international agreements, right?
Well, that's absolutely right. Taiwan simply hasn't got a single tax information exchange agreement. Perhaps more importantly, from our point of view, they haven't signed up to the new OECD Common Reporting Standard, which is the standard that applies to automatic information exchange. Also, the Taiwanese banking law, Article 48, requires complete confidentiality for all other information unless provided in law. And if you look, for example, at the Financial Secrecy Index scoring for Taiwan, the 2015 scoring, you'll see that a whole host of red flags are raised about the secrecy measures in Taiwan. So this is clearly a high secrecy jurisdiction which is not being monitored by the OECD and by the Global Forum. It's not participating in the Global Forum activities. It's one for us to watch very carefully.
John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Here's a question for you, and it's something criminals, kleptocrats and terrorists already know the answer to. Which country is the second easiest place in the world after Kenya to open an anonymous company to launder money? Yes, I'm afraid so. This month, the TaxCast looks at Tax Haven, USA. It's really not rocket science if you want to hide millions or even billions of dollars. In many US states, all you need to do is pay a small fee, fill out a simple form, no ID checks needed, and your stolen money's safe from prying eyes faster than you can say, God bless America. Here's Erin Shornick of Global Witness.
No state collects beneficial ownership information, which is actually the information about the true owner of a company, one who actually exercises control over that company or derives economic benefit from that company. And there's service providers that offer you a company in one day, in 24 hours, and will do all the legwork for you. We've encountered examples where anonymous companies were used to enable drug trafficking, particularly from Mexico, with a company that was incorporated anonymously in Oklahoma. In other instances, we found anonymous companies enabled modern slavery, where companies were incorporated in Kansas, Missouri, and Ohio to trick victims from overseas, and they were able to derive $6 million from their human trafficking scheme. Anonymous companies also enable sanctions busting. An Iranian government used an anonymous New York company to conceal its ownership of a Fifth Avenue skyscraper, and it was in direct breach of sanctions. So those are some of the types of harm that we see, which demonstrate the ways in which anonymous companies are used.
The scale of the problem is huge when you think that nearly 2 million corporations are formed every year in good old Uncle Sam, and most of them don't need to provide even the names or addresses of the true owners.
Oh yeah, if I were a corrupt foreign official, I'd be looking to the United States. We excel at this.
Clark Gascoigne of the Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency Coalition.
The United States is the second easiest place for criminal or terrorists to open an anonymous company to launder their money after Kenya. You know, a bunch of academics did a study on this from Brigham Young University, UT Austin, and Griffith University in Australia a couple years ago, and they drafted emails posing as either clearly corrupt, clearly criminal drug trafficking, or clearly terrorists that should have been raising red flags for whoever they were approaching with their story about how they needed to incorporate companies. And when they came to the United States, the U.S. incorporation services companies were actually the second easiest place for them to do this. They talk about this one guy in Florida where they set off red flags, and the guy says, you know, clearly you're a freaking terrorist, and I'd be crazy to open an account for you, you know, for anything less than $5,000. So he's going to do it. He's just going to charge $5,000 to do it, even though he thinks this is clearly for terrorism.
Clark, do you think that most US citizens understand the central role their country is playing in corruption?
No, they have no idea. I mean, they understand that there's corruption, but they don't have a clue, really, the scale of this problem and the ease with which these anonymous companies can be set up to flagrantly violate U.S. and foreign laws.
And if that academic study passed most ordinary US citizens by, now an expose on the popular investigative TV programme 60 Minutes has turned the spotlight onto the often overlooked players in this game, the corruption enablers. So we've talked about the incorporators of these anonymous companies, but further up the feeding chain are the lawyers. Global Witness went undercover, approached 13 New York law firms and filmed their meetings. They told these lawyers they were advising an African minister who wanted to spend millions on a Gulfstream jet plane, a plush townhouse and a yacht. They said he needed to get the money into the United States without detection. And obviously these are all things that should have screamed dirty money loud and clear. Yet all but one of these lawyers gave informal advice on how to move the cash. Here are some of those conversations captured on Global Witness's hidden camera, starting with the supposed African minister's representative.
If his name now would appear in connection with buying some real estate here and other items, it would look at least very, very embarrassing.
Right, because presumably his salary in wherever it is would not cover the kinds of acquisitions he's been
for sure, that's the salary of a teacher here. And so how can we make sure that he is being able to buy property here and to live a nice life, mm-hmm. but his name being out?
Right.
So presumably we would set up a little bit of a series of owners to try and protect privacy as much as anything else.
Yeah.
So Company A is owned by Company B, which is owned jointly by Company C and D, and your party owns all of or the majority of the shares of C and D.
So we create several companies.
Yes.
And there may be other banking systems, the usual banking havens, I think, would be ones you would want to consider. We could provide you the list of countries where the banking systems require less detail on ownership or source of funds.
You'd set up a Delaware
corporation
to own the real estate.
They don't send the lawyers to jail because we run the country.
Do you run the country?
Still do.
I love it.
Still do.
I should say some lawyers run the country.
So you are some of them, two of them.
Yeah, a small amount.
We're still
yes.
members of a privileged class in this yes. country.
So what does it mean you run the country? It means you...
We make the laws,
and some people say we selectively enforce the laws.
Another way to look at it is the old adage, a good lawyer knows the law, and a great lawyer knows the judge. Okay. Now, in point of fact, I went to law school with half the judges who sit on the New York State Supreme and the Federal District Court in New York. This happens that way over time.
People right.
you knew, people you have lunch with, people you're members of the Bar Association, are they going to throw a case for you? No. But are they going to bend over backwards to be courteous to you? Yes,
yes.
they are.
Now, Global Witness and 60 Minutes point out that the meetings with these lawyers were preliminary. None of the law firms took their pretend African minister on as a client, and no money was moved. Just one lawyer out of 13 didn't want to play ball. Clark Gascoigne.
In the United States, lawyers aren't subject to any sort of money laundering controls the way they are in Europe and other parts of the world. So it's a real problem. And corrupt foreign officials flock to it as their favourite destination.
It's ironic, really, Clark, isn't it, that on the one hand, the United States was named the jurisdiction of greatest concern by the Tax Justice Network recently in their latest financial secrecy index, when the United States actually went up from sixth place to third place as one of the world's most significant players offering financial secrecy services. Yet on the other hand, the United States has been so effective in tackling tax havens like Switzerland, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the United States is in a very uniquely American way of going about things in the world. When they saw that tax evasion was draining money out of the United States, that tax evaders could hide in Switzerland, Americans could hide in Switzerland and not pay their taxes. The United States was fed up and said, that's enough with this one piece of legislation. We're going to put an end to that and require foreign banks to report or they're going to get taxed exorbitantly. And so all the foreign banks came on board and they were going to share information with the United States. The problem is the United States wasn't great about reciprocating.
Right. They created a special law called FATCA, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. So the United States has defended its own interests and tax base against foreign tax havens and stopped a lot of US citizens from hiding their cash. But it's booming as a tax haven for foreigners. Here's Marcus Meinzer of the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index on the United States' resistance to the global standards moving towards greater transparency.
It's really of great hypocrisy how the United States have managed to lash out at the tax havens worldwide. And to be honest and to be fair, we owe the United States a lot in that respect. It has proven great leadership in that regard. In some way, it has managed to break open the Swiss banking secrecy, which would have probably not come about without the United States. But at the moment, it is not clear if and when and to what quality country-by-country reporting requirements will be implemented in the United States. This is combined with the fact that U.S. have managed to hold out from this new automatic information exchange system. They have managed to wriggle through this push for greater transparency by arguing that, well, we have the FATCA law, our own law that provides a lot of information to the United States, but in exchange, what really comes out of the U.S. is a trickle, is really not worth the speak. It's so small, it's so asymmetrical what is in the FATCA agreements. But still, the U.S. used that to hide behind FATCA and say, oh, we do reciprocity. And so this is the current political situation and climate in the U.S. is so hostile to moving anywhere nearer full-fledged membership of the international community and is geared towards U.S. first, U.S. interests alone and above everyone else's.
According to the Tax Justice Network, the United States is a long way from being able to provide information required under genuine reciprocal information exchange because under its domestic law, its banks are still not required to collect the necessary beneficial ownership information. Clark Gascoigne again.
The United States took a couple steps forward a few years ago, but then just plateaued, hasn't moved forward, and the rest of the world is leaping ahead of the United States in tax transparency stuff. In Europe, we're seeing central registries of beneficial ownership becoming the standard. Many of the countries in Europe are going to fully public registries of beneficial ownership information. In Europe, also, the conversation is moving towards full public country-by-country reporting for multinational companies. In the United States, that's been taboo. And then, of course, you know, there's the reciprocal automatic exchange of information. The U.S. sort of put their foot out first and said, we're gonna force people to give us information. And then that spurred this multilateral approach that we're seeing, you know, that the OECD and a lot of almost 100 countries have signed up to. And the United States is continuing to go it alone.
But the Tax Justice Network's got a suggestion to bring the United States back on board. Marcus Meinzer explains.
This is the high time now for European Union to start taking serious action to bring the US back to the negotiation table and to, for instance, introduce a 35% withholding penalty tax for anyone that is investing in the European markets, in the financial markets, but is not willing to fully reciprocate that data. This is only fair and proportional since the United States do exactly the same. They have in their FATCA law this kind of penalty withholding tax. If the European Union want the US really not to become the mega tax haven of the 21st century, then we should be very clear about this requirement. And this is the only language, I'm afraid, the United States at the moment is willing to understand political and economic power.
Straight after the Global Witness and 60 Minutes expose, legislation was proposed in the United States. It's not the first time, but each of these times it is gaining support from both of the main political parties. If this Incorporation Transparency and Law Enforcement Assistance Act is passed, it would end the use of anonymous companies. Of course, there's plenty of opposition to it. Clark Gascoigne.
The biggest opposition to this is the National Association of Secretaries of State. Each state in the United States has a Secretary of State, and they're in charge of doing a bunch of stuff, including running elections in the state and incorporating companies in the state. And when this bill was first introduced a number of years ago, the Secretaries of State of Delaware, Nevada, and Wyoming got really nervous, and they ran to the National Association and asked them to set up a task force, which they then chaired, Nevada, Delaware, and Wyoming. And they came out with this white paper on how this bill would be terrible for states. And so every other state jumped on board and sort of blindly endorsed Delaware, Nevada, and Wyoming's take on this. And the problem with that is that the bill is only going to discourage you from setting up a company if you're up to no good, right? And do we want that money? Do we want those companies to be set up in our country? Delaware receives about anywhere from a quarter to a third of its state budget from incorporation fees. So incorporation fees are a big source of revenue for Delaware, and that's why the Secretary of State's a little concerned about anything that's going to dent Delaware's ability to incorporate companies. It also speaks to why this should be a national law, why we should do this nationally, because if you do it nationally and all states have to do it at once, Delaware is not at a competitive disadvantage to any other state when it comes to incorporating companies. They're on the same level playing field with regards to transparency of ownership.
And another block to progress of this bill is that this is election year in the United States, in case you hadn't noticed, and it's not really a time when politicians are exactly focused on working together. But the toxicity of this issue is poisoning the elections too. The amount of political campaign donations going through anonymous shell companies is on the increase, and that's got worrying implications for democracy.
We're at a real significant risk of corruption in our political system if people can donate anonymously vast sums of money to presidential campaigns and get away with doing this anonymously. Disclosing that a shell company is donating is not actually disclosure. It just raises a lot of questions about the state of democracy in the United States. That's where we are. It's terrifying.
You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.